British physician standing by the truck. "Your friend's doing better. He's stable. And the prognosis is optimistic. Barring any infection, he will be ready to move tomorrow. We should arrange to get him to a hospital where he can receive more advanced care." "Great. Can I see him?"
"Certainly.
He will be groggy from the anesthesia, but you can visit with him."
"Thank you so much, Doctor. I can't thank you enough for saving his life."
Reese shook the physician's hand.
"You saved his life, Mr.
Bucklew. Phil Bucklew," Reese said, conjuring up a name from the past. He trusted the team at Hastings's concession, but not an unfamiliar European working in a medical clinic.
"Where did you receive your training, Mr. Bucklew? Clearly this isn't your first time treating a gunshot wound."
"I was a medic in the Army."
"The U.S. Army?"
"Canadian."
"Ah, I see. Well, you may see your mate now."
Reese headed for the door and looked back at Gona, who sat timidly on the truck's roof. He waved for Gona to follow him and went inside. Solomon was lying on a cot on top of a metal table, his chest and abdomen wrapped in bandages. An IV ran to his arm and an oxygen line wrapped below his nostrils. His face had a grayish hue and his ordinarily fit body hung limp. Reese stood by his side and put his hand on the man's forearm. Gona entered the room slowly and stood in the corner, clearly uncomfortable.
"It's okay, Gona. Doctor says he'll make it.
We'll get him moved to a hospital and he'll be back on his feet in no time." Gona nodded, concerned for his close friend, but reassured by Reese's words. Reese didn't want Solomon to wake up alone, but he also knew that he needed to coordinate his transfer to a more advanced medical facility. They were out of radio range, so he decided it was best to head back to camp to get the ball rolling on the medevac. He took the cap from his head and placed it on the cot next to his tracker. Patting him on the arm, Reese headed out the door. Gona leaned close to Solomon's ear and spoke to him in Shona before following. Reese found the doctor attending to a baby in her mother's arms.
"Hey, Doc, we're going to head back to Rich Hastings' camp and arrange to have him transported to a hospital. Where does he need to go?"
"Well, if you have the funds, I would highly recommend getting him to Johannesburg, or the private clinic in Pemba. There's an airstrip 3 kilometers from here. We have an ambulance that can transport him there for the flight. The nurse in the lobby can give you a card with our phone number, and you can call us from the camp to coordinate."
"Thanks, Doc."
"There's one more thing. Mr. Bucklew, is it?"
"What's that?"
"We run on a shoestring budget here, Mr. Bucklew. We are happy to help your friend, but we are perilously low on resources. A donation would be quite helpful."
"Understood. I'll talk to Mr. Hastings about it."
"Very kind of you, Mr. Bucklew."
The camp had received a broken transmission from Reese just after Solomon was shot. The game scouts were sent to investigate and found the elephant carcass along with the 2 dead poachers. They also found the wrapper for the chest seal and bandages, but weren't sure whether someone on Reese's team was wounded, or if he had wounded and then treated a 3rd poacher. As soon as Reese was back in radio range, he heard Hastings frantically calling for him on their main channel.
"Go for Reese."
"James, what's going on? What's your status? Over."
"We encountered a group of elephant poachers and were compromised. 2 enemy KIA and 2 squirters. Solomon was hit, but he's stable at the clinic. Need you to arrange moving him to a real hospital. Over."
"Roger that, James. Confirm that he is stable and at the clinic in Modipuez. Over."
"Affirmative."
"We will get to work on that immediately. You headed back to camp? Over."
"Roger that. I'm an hour out."
Hastings and his team worked quickly and efficiently. Every man on the team, black or white, was seen as part of the family, and no expense or effort would be spared to ensure Solomon's survival and recovery. The pilot, still waiting for a commercial flight to arrive in Pemba, was dispatched to Montepuez to pick up their wounded man. As soon as he was airborne, Hastings called the clinic to let them know that the plane was on its way. Solomon was loaded into the clinic's humble ambulance and transported the short distance to the airstrip. Within 3 hours of Reese's radio call, Solomon was being treated at the private hospital in Pemba.
Chapter 30. Tirana, Albania, May.
Amin Nawaz slid his aging fingers from one prayer bead to the next as he recited the dhikr.
This was his third location in as many nights, which is how he had lived into his 50th year, an old man in a profession where men died young.
La ilaha illallah.
There is no God but God.
To an outsider, it would look like contemplation or meditation, which, in a sense, it was. In what had become a lifetime of war, the dhikr had been a constant, an escape, the one place Nawaz found peace.
The one place I can go to remember.
The war against the West had entered a new phase. Nawaz had been at it long enough to recognize that. Today he was having a tougher time concentrating than usual. His collaboration with the Russian, a man exiled from the country that Nawaz had traveled so far to defeat in the Afghanistan of the 1980s, was a necessary evil. This time of war, terror, and treachery made for more than a few strange bedfellows, just as it had decades earlier, when the United States and Saudi Arabia had collaborated to fund the Mujahideen with money and weapons to turn against their common enemy. Little did they know they were sowing the seeds of a new battle in an ancient war. Nawaz was nothing if not a pragmatist. The Americans had been very successful in shutting down the flow of money that had once run so freely through Saudi Arabia. If the former Russian GRU colonel wanted to finance the Al-Qaeda operation in Europe, so be it. That he understood Hawala from his time in the waning days of the Soviets' misadventure in Afghanistan allowed them to conduct business off the radar of the NSA, whose analysts fought their war with algorithms from climate-controlled offices in Fort Meade, Maryland. Nawaz would use the Russian until his usefulness expired. Then he would kill him.
Astaghfirullah.
I seek forgiveness from Allah.
Performing the dhikr never failed to transport Nawaz back to the humble home in the kingdom he had shared with his mother, father, and two sisters. With the glow of an early morning dawn just beginning to illuminate his bedroom window, he had felt a presence. At first he had been startled, thinking it was a messenger of Allah. But then he smiled when he recognized the familiar shape of his father. His eyes were closed, and he had rested his hand on his son's head. His lips were moving, yet only slightly, and the young Nawaz strained to hear his words.
La ilaha illallahu wahdahu la sharika lahu lahul mulku wa lahul hamdu wa huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
There is no God but Allah alone, who has no partner. His is the dominion and His is the praise, and He is able to do all things. His father slowly removed his hand from his son's head and pressed a set of beads into Amin's smaller hand. Then, like an apparition you convince yourself didn't exist, his father was gone. Amin was puzzled, as his father had never visited him in the night. He rubbed the beads of the misbaha between his fingers, as he had seen his father do many times. The prayer beads symbolizing the 99 names of Allah were never far from his father's grasp. The young boy curled back into a ball to ward off the early morning chill, the beads clutched tightly against his chest. The date was indelibly etched into his mind. November 20th, 1979. A lifetime later, Nawaz recognized his father's visit for what it was. A goodbye, given in the way of one who is not coming back.
Bismillahi Rahmani Rahim.
In the name of God, the Gracious, the Merciful. Had the West known the chain of events that would be set in motion that early November morning, they might not have sent the GIGN French commandos to help quell the two-week seizure of the Grand Mosque in Mecca. They might not have killed more than 200 of the devoted rebels who had seized it, or publicly beheaded 67 of the captured Wahhabist insurgents in the weeks that followed. The House of Saud might not have capitulated to the terrorists' demands and reversed their progressive policies, adding fuel to the tactic of terror. Amin Nawaz was not the only one who lost a father that day. The Muslim clerics recognized this pool of new recruits, young, fertile minds primed for indoctrination and ready to do battle with the West. The principles of Islam would guide them. Experience on the battlefield of Afghanistan against the Soviet invaders would hone them into mujahideen.
A'udhu billah.
I seek refuge in Allah. Nawaz first met Osama bin Laden in 1988 as a 20-year-old Arab Afghan in the same mountains where he would return to fight the Americans in 2001. He had been one of al-Qaeda's first recruits and had been with Sheikh Osama at one of his last sightings before that Tuesday in September that changed the world forever. It had been at the wedding of one of his most trusted bodyguards where bin Laden had quoted the Holy Quran, "Wherever you are, death will find you, even if you are in lofty towers." Only Nawaz and a few select others understood the significance of that remark. Now, after a lifetime of struggle, spent planning the attacks that would be precursors to what the Americans called the Global War on Terror, and fighting in the Hindu Kush, Iraq, and Syria, he was now the head of al-Qaeda operations in Europe and was close to striking their most devastating blow to date. Sheikh Osama had bunkered down after his escape from Tora Bora and had been rendered relatively ineffective in hiding. He had kept the Western forces at bay, but they had eventually found him. The Americans had slain their dragon. The SEAL commando pigs who shot him down would pay. The defenders of the faith have long memories. Nawaz chose the opposite approach, emulating the security protocols of Yasser Arafat. Well, the Arafat of the Fatah days, anyway, before he grew soft and capitulated to negotiations with the Israelis. Nawaz preferred to stay highly mobile, rarely spending the night in the same place twice, often changing plans and spreading disinformation among his own people, while the U.S. intelligence apparatus sifted through Google and Facebook accounts. Nawaz and the new al-Qaeda he commanded communicated via courier and used the movement of funds via the ancient system of hawala. Systems born of the Silk Road still worked in modern times. The great game continues. The refugees pouring into Europe provided the conduit. More than enough of his fighters had made it into Europe as part of the mass influx of migrants. The very people the West spent such vast sums trying to destroy in foreign lands had been welcomed right into the heart of Europe.
Into the belly of the beast.
Say what one would of the Israelis, they were smart enough to understand the essence of the conflict. They understood. Had the Americans been surrounded by their enemies instead of protected by vast oceans, they might have understood it too, instead of opening their borders to let in the very people bent on destroying them. Though Ayman al-Zawahiri had thus far evaded the special operations teams and drone strikes favored by the enemy, he remained in hiding. As the worldwide leader of al-Qaeda, he had sent Nawaz from Afghanistan first to Iraq and then to Syria to lead Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's operation in the Levant. A brilliant man who had lived for the cause, al-Zawahiri was now entering the twilight of his life. Nawaz had the drive and the energy to be the architect of al-Qaeda's next evolution. While ISIS had captured the headlines and distracted the American military and political machines, Nawaz had patiently built his network, not in the Middle East and Central Asia, but in Europe. America was next. He was proud to have led a group with so many veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That experience had filled the ranks of Jabhat al-Nusra. The West had built their army for them, and then opened the doors into Europe. That would be the next battleground. America would follow, but that duty would fall to the next generation of jihadis, just now finding their voice. The death of the West was not a fantasy. It was an inevitability.
Subhan Allahi wa bihamdihi Subhan Allahi la'adim.
Glory be to Allah and praise Him. Glory be to Allah the Supreme. It had been close to 40 years since his father had last placed his hand on Nawaz's head, and it had been not quite 20 years since the lofty towers had been brought down by Allah.
Stupid Americans!
Didn't they comprehend what was happening? They were killing themselves. While they foolishly spent their treasure and spilled their blood in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen, the very ideology they were fighting to defeat was moving into their cities, their schools, their very government. The freedoms the West championed so proudly would be their ultimate downfall. Those freedoms would be targeted and exploited. Their freedoms were their weakness.
Know thy enemy.
Didn't they realize that 9/11 hadn't been planned in the caves of Afghanistan? The idea had been approved there, but the foot soldiers had done their work in Hamburg, Germany, and in the United States itself. They had learned to fly and blended into communities in California, Arizona, Florida, Virginia, and New Jersey. September 11 had been planned right under the nose of the most powerful nation the world had ever known. Though they had doomed themselves through their culture of political correctness and open borders in the strategic sense, you had to be extremely wary of their tactical acumen. At that level, the Americans could be exceedingly dangerous.
La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah.
There is no might nor power except in Allah. Nawaz knew he would not live to see the sword of Islam sweep across the Americas. This was a generational conflict. Just as the Mongols had altered the ethnic identity of Eurasia, Islam would change the very fabric of Europe and America. Instead of invading on horseback, they would legally immigrate, build their political bases, and incrementally defeat their enemy from within. The very countries whose policies had helped create the refugee crisis were welcoming the enemy with open arms. They were sowing the seeds of their defeat, spurred on by politicians pandering to a new constituency. The Mujahideen of the new millennium didn't need territory to plan and train. The new jihadis could adapt within the very countries they targeted. The Americans projected strength with their tanks and bombers, but they had a soft underbelly. Their comforts and entitlement culture were breeding a weakness. He could prey on their fears. He could inflict further damage to their economy. Even the attacks that failed caused a reaction from the West that continued to cripple their markets. What had been their greatest strength and brought them abundant prosperity was a soft target ripe for exploitation.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Nawaz hesitated on the final bead of the misbaha.
La ilaha illa la.
There is no God but Allah.
Tariq,
he called, summoning the courier who would make contact with a series of what he had learned the West called cutouts. The message would eventually find its way to the man who could decipher it, a man who had been trained by the CIA, but who had proven himself in Syria as a most valuable asset to the cause. He would be the instrument of yet another cut into the soft fabric of Europe. Pressing the encoded note into his courier's willing palm, Nawaz set his hand on Tariq's head and closed his eyes.
Allahu Akbar.
Chapter 31. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, July.
Beast Rhys, the Motorola radio lying on the seat next to him squawked with Rich Hastings' voice.
Go for Rhys.
There's a man here to see you. A Yank. Over.
Shit.
It had been 2 months since Solomon's encounter with the poacher's bullet, and it would be another month until he was back in the field. It was also Reese's first exposure to anyone outside the hunting concession since his arrival.
Had to happen sooner or later.
Check. Did he say who he was?
Negative. He was polite but firm, eh? One of us, from the looks of him. I tried to run him off, but he knows you're here. Over.
Roger that. I'll be there in an hour. Reese out. Reese stopped the cruiser and explained to Gona that he needed to head back to camp. Gona nodded down from the high seat and didn't ask any questions. Reese did a 3-point turn in an open area and began making his way back, though he wasn't exactly in a rush to see whoever it was who was waiting for him. If they knew he was here, there was no sense trying to make a run for it. They'd have UAVs or other assets on him, and Reese had done enough running. He saw a lone, black Land Rover Defender 110 parked in front of the lodge as he pulled into camp. At least whoever had come for him had good taste in vehicles. Instead of pulling around to the back, he stopped the truck next to the Defender and walked up the path toward the broad veranda. The door opened, and a man his own age and height stepped out. Sandy hair fell below his battered Florida Gators ball cap, and his reddish beard betrayed a few flecks of gray. He was dressed in a short-sleeved plaid shirt and jeans and wore Salomon hiking boots. Though he didn't see a handgun, Reese knew there would be one concealed on his right side at the 4 o'clock position, or possibly in an appendix rig just beneath his shirt. His eyes narrowed in recognition as Reese approached the stone steps. Reese stopped and looked up at his old friend, Navy SEAL Senior Chief Freddie Strain.
"I guess you didn't come all this way just to kill me."
"Nah, Reese. If they wanted you dead, they would have droned your ass weeks ago."
The men stood 5 yards from each other, Strain looking down at Reese from the elevated deck. The last time Reese had seen him was months ago, when elements of the United States government had ordered Strain's SEAL team to hunt down and capture or kill their former teammate before he eliminated any more of the conspirators who had planned the killing of his family and SEAL troop. Strain had maneuvered right into Reese's ambush, and Reese had let him live. Neither man spoke for what seemed like an eternity. This time it was Strain who broke the silence.
"Speaking of killing, thanks for not blowing those claymores. I should have known better than to have rolled in there like we owned the place. You had us dead to rights."
"You weren't on my list."
"Thank God for that."
"It's good to see you, brother."
Strain's stoic expression broke into a wide grin.
"You too, Senior."
Reese smiled, climbing the steps to shake Freddy's outstretched hand before embracing him in a hug.
"Damn, Reese, you going for the Jesus look?"
Strain pointed at his friend's shoulder-length, sun-bleached hair and scraggly beard.
"Something like that. Grooming hasn't been a high priority lately."
"I wouldn't think so. Reese, I'm really sorry about Lauren and Lucy. I don't even know what to say to you other than that."
There was an uncomfortable pause as each man considered how to transition to the meat of the conversation. Finally, Reese simply nodded.
"So how'd you find me?"
"Well, it certainly took some doing,"
Freddy answered, relieved to be moving on.
"Let's grab a drink," Reese said, nodding toward the main lodge.
"I think I need one," Freddy said and smiled. "You might too when I tell you why I'm here. Any Basil Haydens?"
"I might be able to scrounge some up," Reese said. "We are fairly well provisioned in that department."
The two frogmen moved through the lodge where Strain stopped to pick up his backpack and out into the dining area. Reese poured 2 fingers of the brown liquid for his friend and opened himself a can of McMahon beer, known locally as 2M. Taking a seat at the bar that overlooked the river below, he motioned for his former teammate to join him.
"If someone had to find me, I'm glad it was you," Reese offered as they touched drinks.
"So," Reese led off again, "how did you do it?" Well, the working theory was that Liz dropped you off somewhere after you took care of Horn, Hartley, and Ben on Fisher's Island. We couldn't confirm that, since she's still on a nice estate in Mexico, protected by an army of lawyers, courtesy of your buddy Marco.
He's a good one, that Marco, Reese said, taking another sip of Mozambique's finest.
Turns out he's a little more than just a good businessman, and even I'm not cleared to know exactly what he's involved with, but my guess would be he's a highly placed DEA asset. I don't have a need to know, so that really is just a guess.
I'd bet it's a good guess, Reese confirmed.
Well, we would never have figured out that you liberated the Hastings' boat if a few other pieces hadn't fallen into place. Even if we had, we would have assumed you were killed at sea in the storm the night of your escape. Never in a million years would we have thought to look for you here, Fred continued, gesturing at the surrounding wilderness.
It was a bit of a trek, Reese admitted with a smile.
I'll say. I'd love to hear how you did it at some point.
Trade secrets, my friend. And maybe a bit of luck. To be honest, it was a lot of luck.
They say it's better to be lucky than good, Reese.
Isn't that the truth? But you didn't find me because some yacht club finally noticed a boat went missing.
True. It started with the East African desk at the agency coordinating with the NSA on Chinese interests in Mozambique. The signals guys intercepted a series of Chinese intelligence reports detailing a major shift in anti-poaching efforts on this particular concession. The meat poachers feed the workers the Chinese use to support their mining and logging operations, and it was beginning to impact their productivity.
It's nice to know it was working.
Yeah, enough for them to mention it to hire. Now that alone would never have raised any eyebrows, but when a white guy with an American accent claiming to be a former Canadian Army medic brings a wounded tracker into an East African medical clinic without a good explanation as to why he knows how to do a tension pneumothorax and apply an Asherman chest seal, well, that's not something they see every day. Unfortunately for you, the doctor that you encountered is an MI6 asset.
Are you kidding me? Is there anyone in this country who isn't some kind of spook?
You would have gotten away clean not very long ago, but our intelligence collection capability has grown exponentially over the years. That, along with our ability to sift through mountains of information, can now be done at speeds unheard of in the past.
I still don't see how a cable saying the Chinese have some hungry workers, coupled with a stitched-up game reserve tracker, led them to believe I somehow made it from New York to Moe's when they weren't looking for me here to begin with.
It wasn't them, Reese. It was me.
Reese looked quizzically at his former sniper school spotter.
I know you, remember? And I know Rafe. And I know that you two spent time at Rafe's uncle's hunting operation in Africa when you were in college together.
Thanks for remembering, Reese said sarcastically, taking another long drink.
Africa got me thinking. So I checked on all Rafe's family's East Coast-based planes and boats. Guess which one disappeared the same night you did?
You missed your calling, Freddy. You should have been a detective. Maybe in my next life.
And Reese, next time you kill the Secretary of Defense and unravel the biggest government conspiracy in modern history, you might not want to give your name as Phil Bucklew to a British spy at an East African medical clinic.
Reese shook his head.
Yeah, using the name of one of the legends of naval special warfare was probably not the best move. After that, we put up a UAV and have had you under surveillance for the past couple weeks. Facial recognition works, even from 15,000 feet.
Lucky me.
Freddy paused. I guess you know I didn't come all the way here to go hunting with you. I figured you were here to kill me or arrest me. I'm guessing arrest me. That's where this gets complicated. I'm leaving here as soon as we're done, but I'm not dragging you out against your will. Let me run this by you and you can make the call. You'll want to hear it all, though.
Doesn't seem like I have much of a choice.
I have something I need you to see, Freddy said,
sliding off his bar stool and motioning for Reese to follow him.
Might want to snag a couple more drinks.
Strain pulled a tin of Copenhagen from the pocket of his jeans and packed it with several flicks of his wrist. He opened the tin and put a pinch of tobacco between his lip and gum before offering the can to Reese, who shook his head.
When did you start dipping?
When a wife made me quit drinking, Fred responded, motioning to the bourbon in his hand with a gleam in his eye.
I think she meant only in the States, though.
I'm absolutely sure that's what she meant. How is Joni?
She's good, man. She never really loved Virginia Beach, so she was happy when I got out and could live wherever she wanted. We're down in South Carolina near her family.
So you're not at the command?
No, I got out a few months back.
Things got really weird after you skipped town.
Your friend Katie's reporting put the spotlight on all of the Hartley's shenanigans, and the shit rolled downhill pretty hard.
I don't blame you for what you did, Reese. If we had had any idea what the real story was, we'd have helped you knock those bastards off instead of targeting you.
Reese nodded.
So I guess I'm public enemy number one.
Yes and no.
When the whole story came out, it certainly eased up the pressure to find you or confirm your death at sea. The conversation shifted to the Hartleys, the capstone finance operation, and all that. Even the conspiracy theory people started looking mainstream. You became a little bit of a Robin Hood type. There were James Reese sightings everywhere. You were like Elvis for a while.
What about my friends? Reese asked, not mentioning names.
The reporter, Katie? She's untouchable, at least for now. No one would go near her with a 10-foot pole. She had the best law firms in the country lining up to insulate her from questioning by any government investigators. DOJ is ready to go after your friend Liz Riley and have her extradited to the U.S., but the president has them at bay for now.
Why would the president do that? Wasn't he part of Hartley's bunch?
Jesus, you don't know, do you? Strain looked bewildered.
Know what?
That the president resigned over this whole thing.
What? That's crazy.
Yep. The fact that he was letting the SecDef run DOD like it was her own kingdom and piggy bank was too much for even the media.
How could you not have heard about that?
Guess I just wasn't looking. You can really lose yourself out here, Reese said, gesturing to their surroundings. The only news comes in over a radio in the main office, and most all of that is local. This is the land that time forgot.
Well, the long and the short of it is, the media loved a good story even more than they loved the administration. The Republicans in Congress had all of the wives and kids of the dead guys from your troop on TV demanding his resignation, and it worked. He stepped down and Roger Grimes, the VP, took over to finish out his term. He's a good guy, old Army 06 that they put on the ticket to keep Middle America happy. He never really fit in with the old boss, and he's already said he's not running for re-election. The parties are going nuts. Hartley was the Dems' chosen one, and with her gone, they're slashing each other's throats trying to posture for the job. The Republicans smell blood, and half the governors in the country are now looking to run. It will be a crazy primary on both sides. Anybody could win. Fun to watch for a political junkie like me.
I still can't believe you haven't heard any of this.
Look around, Reese said. No internet, no newspapers. Main concerns here are the environment, the animals, and poaching.
Well, whether you wanted to or not, you changed the course of U.S. political history.
I wasn't trying to take down the system. They just needed to pay for what they did to my troop and my family. They got what they deserved.
I agree. We were part of the investigation, since they had us out looking for you on domestic soil. The entire command had to stand down. I had 22 years in and the option to take this job, so I made the leap.
So, you're with the agency now?
Yep. And that's why I'm here, even though I'm kind of a new guy. You ready to hear my sales pitch?
Reese nodded. Strain took an iPad from his backpack, entered a long passcode, and selected an icon on the screen.
You came to Mozambique to show me a PowerPoint? Strain laughed. High-tech, Reese, our manila envelope days are over.
Strain held the screen so that Reese could see it. It was a file image of Kingston Market fully decorated for Christmas. Strain swiped the surface to advance to the next photo, and a close-up picture of a deceased 8-year-old girl in a pink winter coat filled the screen. The next image was an aerial view of the market post-attack.
Kingston Market on the outskirts of London. They hit a Christmas event with a VBIED and bottlenecked the crowd here at the other end. Two guys with PKMs opened up on the survivors from these two rooftops and then blew themselves up with S-vests. It was bad. Really bad. They killed close to 300 people outright, with more dying later in the hospitals. Total dead was 378. Hundreds more were wounded. A lot of amputations. More than half of the victims were kids.
Reese looked away from the screen.
Yeah, man, bad stuff. Strain continued. Not only did they kill and wound all those innocent people, they crippled the brick-and-mortar retail economy all over the West. People were scared to go Christmas shopping. The malls were empty despite tons of beefed-up security. The stock markets got spooked. The global impact of these attacks was enormous.
I'm honestly surprised that we don't see this kind of attack more often, Reese said solemnly.
I agree with you.
Who's behind it? ISIS?
They took credit, of course, but every jihadist organization in the book is calling themselves ISIS now. This is actually a little more organized than the typical ISIS-inspired attack by a bunch of lone wolf types affiliated through social media. This is a real network, AQ in Europe. Check this one out.
Strain moved to another series of images.
Right after the market attack, they hit a formation of British paras with a mortar barrage during an awards ceremony. Poor guys had just returned from Afghanistan and got ripped up right before their Christmas leave. Only reason they didn't kill the Prince of Wales is that his motorcade arrived late.
So this isn't a one-off?
Nope. As a matter of fact, they just killed the NATO commander in Brussels, an Army four-star. They blew him up in front of his wife. He was all set to retire, too. Good guy, from what I understand.
Bastards, Reese said, shaking his head.
But what does this have to do with me? The charge that killed the general, it was delivered via drone.
What?
That's right. Defeated the armor in his vehicle by putting a drone on the roof with a shaped charge. An EFP sliced him in two, same way you killed that Jaish al-Mahdi lieutenant in Iraq back in 06.
That was an agency deal, buddy. And that drone was huge. Experimental CIA bird, if I remember correctly.
You're right. Technology has come a long way since then. UAVs are smaller, more powerful, GPS programmable, but the idea is the same, so we started tracking down everyone involved in your op in Baghdad. We think you know the cell leader responsible for the NATO attack.
Strain swiped to display an image, obviously taken by a surveillance team with a long telephoto lens.
No way. Is that Mo?
Reese asked, unable to contain his surprise at the photo of his old comrade.
That's right, your buddy Mohammed Farouk from Baghdad. The agency trained him to build mini EFPs and taught him how to fly a drone to deliver an explosive payload. He fell off the radar back in the summer of 2014 when ISIS started sweeping across Iraq. He'd worked with the coalition and would be a dead man if they caught him, probably tortured first. He was rumored to be in Syria working with the al-Nusra Front, an anti-Assad group now called Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. Next thing you know, AISI spots him in Italy, which is where this photo came from. They lost track of him after that, and no one thought much of it until these attacks.
What makes you think he was involved? Why wouldn't he just disappear? Mo's no terrorist.
MI5's assets point to a network that is pulling the strings on a lot of the radical elements that have come in as asylum seekers. There are so many newly arrived refugees from Muslim countries that all the European security agencies are overwhelmed, chasing down jihadi elements. We think they're hiding in plain sight.
Strain advanced to a new image. This is Amin Nawaz. He's a Saudi but hasn't set foot in the kingdom for close to 20 years. He's original Mooj, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and now Europe. He's running the show while UBL's son Hamza bin Laden prepares to take the reins.
Wasn't bin Laden's son killed in the raid in 2011?
That was a different son. Hamza was off at a terrorist training camp studying the family business, so he lived to fight another day. Until he's ready, Nawaz is the number one terrorist on our list and the mastermind of these recent attacks in Europe. Multiple independent sources with reliable reporting histories confirm that Mohammed Farouk and Amin Nawaz worked together in Syria. We think that your buddy Mo runs one of his cells in Europe. He would be highly trained courtesy of the program you ran with the CIA in Iraq and his follow-on experience in Syria with Nawaz. Reese shook his head. I can't believe Mo is involved, but nothing out of Iraq should surprise me, I guess.
Still don't understand what this has to do with me. Mo and I were friends, but that was a long time ago. I haven't seen or spoken to him in at least 10 years.
We know. I'm here because you are the only one, as far as we can tell, left alive who worked with him.
How can that be? Reese asked. A lot of SEALs rotated through that position over the years, not to mention the scores of agency people.
It's really not as many people as you think. I've been through the documents. Brent got killed in Coast, and Eckert had a heart attack in freaking Vegas, of all places. He was at SHOT, and somebody joked that the president had signed an executive order banning ARs and 30-round mags. He just fell over dead. Weirdest thing. The last guy's Landry, who just also happened to be working with you and Mo on the drone op in Iraq. No one knows where he is.
That's probably for the best. I had a run-in with him in Iraq when we were both working with Mo. He liked the interrogations a little too much. Caught him going off the reservation on the Iraqi side of camp. I reported it up the CIA chain. Never heard anything after that, and I was rotated out soon afterward. I never liked that guy. But I don't think he's bright enough to build an EFP without blowing himself up.
That very well may be. The agency is trying to track him down, and they have some questions for him.
Why do you need somebody who knows Mo to take him out? Can't the Brits just pick him up? They're great at this sort of thing.
That's the catch. We don't want him dead. We want someone that he knows and trusts to flip him. Use him to track down Amin Nawaz and dismantle the network. If he's already swapped sides once, we know he's not an idealist. We just need to make him an offer he can't refuse. We need Nawaz's head on a spike, Reese. It's kind of like a shark attack. The public isn't going back into the water until we show them a dead shark.
You're not going to start playing Lee Greenwood and tell me that my country needs me, are you?
Nope, you only fall for that once.
Reese sat in silence, staring past Strain. Then, you know I'm dying, right?
The tumors that the Hartley's medical experiment gave me and my team? They're terminal.
Fred grinned.
Funny that you mention that. You are going to want to hear this.
He closed the slideshow and selected an audio player icon, tapping it twice to make it play. A voice from the past filled the African air.
Hello, Mr. Reese. This is Dr. German. We've been trying to get in touch with you. We usually don't leave messages like this, but I wanted you to hear this as soon as possible. Your biopsy came back, and under the circumstances, it is the best news that we could expect. Your tumor is what's called a cerebral convexity meningioma, which is a very common and slow-growing lesion. Based on the type and location of the mass, I am very confident that I can remove it surgically. We are talking a 75% or better survival rate. It could be causing you headaches, which is nothing to be alarmed about. Please call us back and my assistant will schedule you an appointment for a follow-up. We can speak in more detail at my office. Again, sorry to have to leave this on your voicemail, but I didn't want you to worry needlessly. Have a great day, and enjoy your new lease on life, Commander.
Reese's entire body flushed. Whatever Freddy said next came through as complete nonsense, like he was underwater.
It's real, Reese. You're going to be fine, bro. Welcome back to the world of the living.
What the... How did you... Where did you get that?
It was on your voicemail, man. It was just sitting on your voicemail.
Reese stood and walked away from the table, fighting a sudden smothering sensation. He found himself by the stone fire pit overlooking the river below. Was it possible for him to live again, after all he had done? His family was still dead. Dead because of a conspiracy to monetize a war by those who had never spent a day in combat, content to sit back immune to the consequences of their vile decisions. Or so they believed. He stood there alone for several minutes until he heard Strain's footsteps behind him.
I'm done working for the government, Freddy. I'm done with that life. I understand, Reese. And I know this is a lot to process. It's not just about you, though. I'm not even going to lay the line on you about protecting civilians and all that, even though it's true. Remember what I said about DOJ being ready to prosecute Liz?
Yeah? Reese's jaw tightened in anger.
That's a stick, Reese. If you don't play ball, they'll go after her. Aiding and abetting. Conspiracy. They'll try to ruin her. Rafe and his sister, too. Marco, if they can find him. Clint. Everyone they can find who helped you. When the government sets its sights on destroying you, all the lawyers in the world won't stop them. Might slow them down, but that's it.
Fuck.
Nothing in Reese's makeup would allow him to stand by while those who stepped up for him had their lives destroyed by a vindictive government. The agency sure knows what buttons to press.
So what's the carrot?
You get your life back. You and all your accomplices will be given presidential pardons. Little-known fact, you don't need to be convicted of anything to be pardoned. It's like immunity, but it's preemptively coming from the president. All is forgiven. Flip Mo, take out his boss, go on with your life.
What life? Go back and pretend that my wife and daughter weren't murdered in our home? Will the president bring them back too?
I'm sorry, man. I didn't mean it like that. All I'm saying is that you won't be a wanted man.
And Mo, what happens to him?
He goes down, buddy. After what he did to those kids in London, he goes down, and he goes down hard.
Reese shook his head.
There has got to be something we can offer to make him flip. The way this is set up, he gets the same deal regardless if he helps us or not.
What are you saying, Reese?
I'm saying I'll need leverage. Unless you have his family in Gitmo, we are going to need to offer an option. Maybe take the death penalty off the table and offer up life in something other than solitary confinement.
I'll take that back to the bosses.
Reese paused again, looking out toward what was turning into a beautiful African sunset, and thinking of those he had put in the ground on his crusade to avenge his family and the lives of the men killed under his command in the mountains of Afghanistan.
Why would they let me go free after all I did?
Two reasons, I think. First of all, there's a sizable chunk of the American public that thinks you're a hero. No one is looking to keep this story going any longer, especially with the election coming up. Second, and this may be the bigger reason, the U.S. and Eurozone economies are in the toilet with a new terror threat on the horizon. You've got retailers about to go under en masse. They were just coming out of the recession, and now the public and the markets are scared shitless. The EU is on the verge of breaking up. This mass influx of refugees, certainly hiding a percentage of current would-be terrorists, is part of that instability. The whole system is a house of cards that relies on the public trust, and right now, we're losing that. We need a dead terrorist, and we need him now.
Reese sighed.
So, who's my handler?
You're looking at him.
Could be worse, I guess. Reese smiled. How does this work, logistics-wise?
Pretty simple, really. Your early retirement from the Navy will be approved instantly. You were never indicted or arrested, so there are no actual charges to worry about. DOJ has made it clear to all of the state and local agencies that this is their show, so you won't have to worry about any local DAs deciding to make a name for themselves. You'll come to work for us as a contractor, which will give you and the agency maximum flexibility.
Terrific, Reese said sarcastically.
It's a contracted position. You won't pay taxes on most of it as long as you're working overseas. Added to your retirement pay and benefits, and it's better than the dollar a day you'd earn making license plates in prison.
That does sound a bit better.
Where does the brain surgery fit into all this?
That's a bit of a catch. As soon as we can, we are going to scan your brain and compare it with the scans you had done at the clinic in La Jolla to give us a better idea of what we're dealing with. With the latest 3 attacks in Europe, this thing is time-sensitive. We'll do a quick workup before attempting to make contact with Mo. Unless things have taken a drastic turn for the worse, the surgery will have to wait until he's been flipped and Nawaz is in the ground.
That's the government I know. Where are Mo and Nawaz now?
We're not sure. The analysts are working it. In the meantime, we've got to get you tuned back up. There's a compound in Redacted where we can train and plan. You're still a recognizable face, so we need to keep you off the grid until this op kicks off. Once we know where Mo is, you and I will move in and get to work.
The government sure knows how to make you an offer you can't refuse.
Art of the deal, buddy, Freddy said with a smile.
When do we leave?
As soon as I make the call.
Any chance we can take off in the morning? I have to settle up around here.
Yeah, we can make that happen.
Thanks, Freddy.
Strain rose to retrieve his Iridium satellite phone and placed a call to Langley, letting them know he had successfully recruited America's most wanted domestic terrorist.
Chapter 32. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, July. Rich took the news like a man who knew it was coming. Though he obviously wasn't surprised, he was visibly saddened. Hastings had come to look at Reese less like his nephew's friend and more like his own blood. With little family left in Africa, it pained him to see Reese leaving. He could see that Reese had found both peace and purpose here in Mozambique, and he was worried that with the appearance of the new American in camp, he was now destined for neither. Though Rich understood Reese's reasons for leaving, he was inflexible on one point. Ever the gracious host, he insisted that Reese and Freddy join the camp in a final farewell dinner. Reese gave his friend a tour of the camp before watching a breathtaking sunset over the river. Beer was flowing by the time Rich Hastings made his appearance at the lodge, leaning his heavy double rifle against a chair and hanging his worn leather ammunition belt next to it.
"Rich, this is my buddy Freddy Strain. We go back a long way."
"Has it, Freddy?" Reese could sense the reservation in Hastings' voice.
"Pleasure to meet you, Mr. Hastings. I know your nephew. He's a good man."
"Rich, don't hold it against Freddy that I have to go. He's just the messenger."
"Mr. Hastings, is that a Wesley Richards drop lock?" Freddy motioned toward Rich's rifle nearby.
Reese grinned.
"You know your guns, Freddy. Please call me Rich."
Hastings walked toward the rifle and broke open the action, slipping the Panatella-sized cartridges into his hip pocket. He offered the gun to Freddy, who set down his drink and wiped his hands on his pants to ensure that they were dry. He took the rifle as if it were the Queen's scepter, eyes wide. To the casual observer, the rifle looked a lot like a double-barrel shotgun. It was, in fact, a massive rifle with juxtaposed bores larger than a half inch in diameter. Often referred to as an elephant gun, its 750-grain bullets would stop a charging Tyrannosaurus. This particular model was crafted by one of the gun trade's most prestigious makers in Birmingham, England, during what is widely regarded as the golden age of gun making. A new one would run the buyer about as much as a Range Rover, and even one with this many miles on it would fetch a working man's annual salary at auction.
577, wow!
Wesley hasn't made 100 of these, Freddy said as much to himself as those around him.
That one is number 25, Hastings proclaimed with pride.
That would make it between the wars, would it not?
Indeed it would, lad. This rifle belonged to my father and his father before him.
Even Hastings couldn't help but smile now. He looked on as his new guests slowly turned the gun to admire the exquisite rose and scroll engraving, the swirling grays, blues, and purples of the faded case-colored frame, and the rich marbling of the reddish walnut stock. Though the gun was close to 100 years old and had been carried for countless miles in the bush, it was in surprisingly good condition. Every ding in the stock, every tiny scratch in the metal, told a story. The most prominent sign of wear on the gun came near the twin muzzles of the thick barrels, where the deep, blued finish was worn silver, like the pale skin under a man's wristwatch. Rich had carried the rifle over his shoulder with his right hand gripping the barrels in the African style. Over the decades, the sweat and friction from Hastings's hand had worn completely through the finish.
"Why is it called a drop lock?" Rhys asked, baiting Freddy into showing his encyclopedic knowledge of firearms.
"May I?" Freddy looked at Hastings with hesitation.
"Please do."
Strain snapped the barrel shut, turned over the rifle, and removed the checkered walnut forend. He lifted a hinged plate on the bottom side of the rifle's action and removed a jeweled metal part.
"This is one of the locks." Freddy held the Victorian-looking steel object in his palm. "These guns were designed to be used in places like this where there were no gunsmiths to be found for hundreds of miles, and where sending the rifle back to England meant weeks of sea travel. The best of them came with a spare set of locks that the hunter could carry in his gear and replace in the field if something broke. As you can see, these locks drop right out of the bottom of the action, hence the drop lock," Freddy concluded, winning Rich over with his knowledge and enthusiasm for the classic rifle. Throughout dinner, Rich captivated Strain with war stories from the Rhodesia days. Rhys couldn't recall an instance when Freddy had stayed quiet for so long. As they finished the feast of Cape Buffalo filet and fresh vegetables, Rich took a more serious tone.
"I won't pretend that I don't know who you two blokes will be working for. But let me explain my reservations. When our Prime Minister agreed to end the Bush War and turn the country over to majority rule, a man named Abel Muzorewa was elected Prime Minister and led the interim government. He was a good man, a bishop of all things. The war didn't stop, though, because the bloody communists didn't control Parliament. Those pulling the strings in Washington and London felt that the new government was too cozy with the European settlers, so they sent in the CIA to disrupt things. We caught them red-handed, meddling in our constitutional process, and we rounded up the entire ring. In exchange for their agents' return, the US government agreed to drop their sanctions and recognize the interim government. Like fools, we took the deal, and Carter and his people stabbed us in the back, pretending it never happened. Now, I don't blame the CIA men. They were following orders. They were tools, though. Pawns of a government that would break any agreement to get what they wanted. The CIA actually had the gall to try to recruit me to bury weapons caches and mark coordinates for possible runways, DZs and LZs. Ah, but that's a story for another day. Don't forget what I told you, boys. You're good blokes. Be wary of politicians meddling in the affairs of other nations, ordering young men like you to their deaths in exchange for re-election.
After an uncomfortable pause, Louis made a toast to Rhys, which broke the tension and effectively ended the dinner. It was time to say goodbye to the camp staff, the trackers, the cooks, the skinners, the maids, the people whom Rhys had grown to know like family over the past 4 months. They stood single file in the main lodge, with hats in hand as a sign of respect. One by one, they approached Rhys and either hugged him or shook his hand. Rhys had a gift for each of them, a headlamp, a knife, a pair of boots that looked as though they might fit. He gave away virtually all his possessions. These seemingly ordinary items were treated as treasures by the staff. Finally, the procession thinned out, leaving only Gona and Solomon. Gona, a man of few words, said nothing lest the tears that filled his eyes spill down his cheeks.
"Saramushe, Gona," said Rhys.
Gona merely nodded in response, gripping Rhys's hand tightly, before half-hugging him and turning quickly away. Solomon stood alone in his olive coveralls, looking none the worse for wear, despite having recently been on the brink of death.
"You saved my life, Mr. James. I cannot thank you."
"You've been a great friend, Solomon. That's thanks enough. Take care of yourself, and take care of Gona, too. I'll come back one day." That brought a wide smile to Solomon's face. He pulled an object from his pocket that looked like black wire wrapped in a small circle and handed it to Rhys, who recognized it as a traditional elephant hair bracelet, woven from the thick hair of the tail with four rectangular knots spaced equally around the circumference.
"This is from the cow, Mr. James, where I was shot. I hope that she brings you luck."
Now it was Rhys's turn to choke up, knowing that Solomon had walked miles to the site of his own near-death shooting to recover the slain animal's tail and weave it into a bracelet for the man who saved his life. Rhys spent one final night in his open hooch, listening to the sounds of the hippos and elephants in the river below, a lion roaring somewhere to the west. He slept little, his thoughts racing to process the news that he wasn't dying after all. "Are they really going to pardon me? Pardon my friends? Is this a trap? How could Mo be working for ISIS?" His last thought as he finally drifted off to sleep was of an explosives-laden drone settling onto the roof of an SUV in Baghdad. At dawn, a Pilatus landed on the strip where Rhys had first arrived many weeks ago. Rhys caught a look at the pilot through the plexiglass window, secretly hoping to see his friend Liz Riley. Unless she'd grown a beard, it wasn't her. The two passengers disembarked, a junior case officer from the Tanzanian embassy and an interpreter to drive Strain's Defender 110 back to Dar es Salaam. Strain shook Rich Hastings's hand and climbed aboard the idling aircraft, leaving Rhys and Hastings to say their goodbyes.
"I can't thank you enough for all that you've done for me, Rich."
"You would have done the same for me, James. Family looks after one another. Here, take this. You never know when you may need it."
Hastings handed Rhys a small sheath knife, its handle made from smooth ebony. Rhys pulled the blade from the leather scabbard and saw a stylized osprey engraved on the side, perched on a rocker that read, "Pamwechete," the motto of the famed Celis Scouts, meaning "all together."
"I can't accept this, Rich."
"My fight is over, James. Yours has just begun. Take it, and be well."
Rhys reached into his bag and brought out his Winkler Sioc tomahawk, handing it to the man he now saw as family.
"Thank you. Thank you for showing me how to live again."
Before the older man could protest, Rhys turned and boarded the plane. As they lifted off, he saw Hastings standing beside his white Land Cruiser, watching yet another sun depart old Africa. Part 2. Transformations.
Chapter 33. South of Redacted. July. The flight to Redacted was uneventful. A bird from a covered air program run by the agency delivered them to Redacted. Reese remained quiet most of the trip, reflecting on his last few months in the bush and processing the news that Freddy had brought him from halfway around the world. I am going to live. That meant he had to live with the pain of losing his wife, daughter, and unborn son. He also had to make peace with the fact that he was going to work for the same government that had tried to destroy him. He was being given a second chance, just one last mission, and he was free. Free to do what? That was a question he needed some time to work out. Reese had been prepared for death for so long, ready to join his wife and daughter. Had he forgotten how to live? Nice truck, Reese commented, gesturing toward the beige Toyota Hilux waiting on the tarmac.
I know. These things are great. Too bad you can't get them in the States. You don't still have that old Land Cruiser, do you?
Ha, well, I did until a few months ago. Had I known I wasn't dying, I might have stashed her away for a rainy day, Reese smiled, climbing into the passenger seat as Freddy put the truck in gear and began to weave his way toward the exit. Reese had first met Freddy Strain when they were both enlisted SEALs just prior to 9/11. Fred had enlisted a year after Reese. He had a reputation as a smart guy and a capable operator. They were in the same sniper school class and were assigned as shooting partners, which meant they were more or less married for the duration of the school. What are we listening to? Is this Waylon Jennings? Reese asked, as a pseudo-psychedelic country rock melody floated into the air.
This is Sturgill Simpson, man. Great sound. Reminds me of the country my dad would play back in the 70s.
Freddie had grown up in Stuart, Florida, which is just south of Fort Pierce, where the original Navy frogmen were trained during World War II. When Freddie should have been studying, he was fishing and diving off the nearby Atlantic coast, or swatting mosquitoes while working on old cars in his family's garage. He came from a blue-collar family in a very white-collar town, and had a bit of a chip on his shoulder when it came to others' expectations of him. He was an avid reader and scored highly on all the aptitude tests, but he just couldn't make himself care about high school. Other than a few history courses that piqued his interest, the only A's on his report cards came from the multiple shop classes that he took each semester. On Veterans Day of his senior year, his dad took him to the annual muster at the UDT SEAL Museum in Fort Pierce, the site of the old training grounds. Freddie watched in awe as active duty SEALs performed live demonstrations of raids and ambushes, complete with blank-firing machine guns and demolitions, scaled the sides of the museum building without ropes, and parachuted onto the museum grounds from aircraft circling high above. The following Monday, he was in the recruiting office, signing delayed enlistment papers. Freddie was living proof that not all stereotypes are true. In the Hollywood version, the sniper is always a quiet loner who lives for the solitude of the stalk. Freddie Strain was the opposite. He basically never stopped talking, unless silence was absolutely necessary. Even then, Reese was sure he was thinking about what to say next. Freddie made up for not studying in high school by reading about subjects that interested him. He could talk about anything. Arcane historical information, Keynesian economics, Nietzschean philosophy, his family, or the ignition timing of a 1956 Ford. But he especially loved to talk about guns. While Reese believed guns were tools of the trade and that armorers and gunsmiths existed for a reason, Freddy was obsessed with every single moving part. He constantly debated the best weapon, best optic, best bullet, and made modifications to nearly every piece of equipment he carried. His teammates used to joke that if anyone ever broke into Freddy's house, they'd get away before he decided which gun to use on them. His biggest concern was always having the perfect setup for any contingency.
When the operators at his most recent command went for beers after work, Freddy would be in the armory, tweaking his weapons.
Reese, you missed some of the latest SEAL drama while you were away.
What do you mean?
Remember that fucker Martell?
Oh yeah, what an asshole. Elitist snob, if I remember correctly.
Yep, total hypocrite. Turns out that as commanding officer of the training center, just as we are about to welcome our first buds class with females, he gets caught sending pictures of his crank to female subordinate sailors in his chain of command. Turns out he was a total perv the whole time he's playing the holier-than-thou role as CO. Unbelievable. Some reporter got wind of it and started asking questions, but the Navy used the ongoing investigation garbage to conceal it, while Martell quickly and quietly retired. The old dick pic, always a hit with the ladies, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
Agreed. Wonder how having women come through the program is going to change things. I mean, you want your daughter to have all the opportunities that men have and feel like they can't do anything they... Freddy's voice trailed off. I'm sorry, buddy, I didn't mean your daughter. I just meant... in general.
Sorry, buddy.
That's okay, Reese responded, attempting to hide the hurt in his eyes. I'll never get over losing them. Now that I'm not dying, I guess I just keep moving forward. I thought I was done, buddy. My grave was already dug. Not sure if that makes it easier or harder to live with what I did.
Well, you certainly improved on the old before embarking on a journey of revenge, dig two graves, one for yourself proverb, Freddy said, smiling, trying to lighten the mood. I think you did a bit more digging than the original author had in mind. They had it coming.
Don't we all? Freddy asked, suddenly serious again. Seeing the conversation as an opening into his friend's well-being, Freddy ventured,
Think you can move on without Lauren?
Reese paused, unsure not only of how to respond to his old sniper school buddy, but also of how he actually felt.
I don't know, brother.
Seems almost sacrilegious to even talk about it. Lauren and Lucy were my life. I felt this devotion to country that kept me in the teams. It's funny, had the war not happened, I probably would have gotten out long ago and Lauren and Lucy would still be alive.
You're out now.
Yeah, I keep forgetting. Seems like I'm back on the USG leash, Reese said, using the abbreviation for United States Government.
True, almost like the old days, Freddy grinned.
You want to tell me where we're going?
Not much longer now. I've only been here once before. It's a former black site where we used to bring suspected terrorists when we wanted another country to do our dirty work for us, part of the extraordinary rendition program started after 9/11.
I remember, Reese affirmed. Fairly effective from what I can recall, that is until the media and the enemy figured it out.
Exactly. Just finding out we had black sites was a big PR win for them, kind of like the very existence of Guantanamo. I'm not sure how we measure the ROI, but the law of diminishing returns would indicate that at some point the enemy got more out of those from a recruitment and world sentiment standpoint than the value of the actual intel we got from using them.
Such a tough call, and another reason we have civilian control of the military, said Reese.
Yeah, on a certain level. It almost condoned certain behaviors that we ended up having a lot of trouble with at my former command and in the military in general. Desecrating bodies, tactical interrogations that went too far.
Freddy paused.
It was interesting, though, Reese. Everyone who came from working with you always was a bit more thoughtful about it. They said you talked about the importance of maintaining the moral high ground to differentiate us from our enemies. I don't think they got that from any others.
Reese shook his head. I threw that right out the window when they killed my family.
No, you didn't, Reese. Never think that. You just went to war, plain and simple. They killed Lauren and Lucy. They killed your entire troop, tried to kill you. You held them accountable.
Just because you broke a few laws doesn't mean you lost the moral high ground. You always held that territory.
Thanks, Freddy, Rhys said, looking out at the desolate yet beautiful desert scenery.
You ever do any of those diaper runs? Rhys asked his friend, using the agency slang for the kinetic side of extraordinary rendition due to the use of diapers on terrorists snatched off the street in Country X on the way to Country Y as both a means of humiliation and practicality.
No, by the time I got to the agency, that program was pretty much over. Too much controversy. Though what we're about to do sure comes close.
And besides, I came on just to find you. Freddy smiled again.
Gee, thanks,
Rhys responded, not attempting to hide his sarcasm.
No problem, and thanks again for not putting me in one of those revenge graves, Freddy said, thinking of everyone Rhys had put in the ground avenging his family and SEAL troop.
You're welcome, Rhys returned with just the slightest hint of a smile, before shaking his head and continuing more to himself than to his friend.
I just couldn't do it, man. I saw you down there in the kill zone, and suddenly everyone down there became a version of you. Guys with families, kids, dogs, aspirations, dreams. Not only did you save everyone's lives that day, you probably saved mine. I'm not sure I could live with myself had I followed through with it. I was just so blinded by what I needed to do that I almost ambushed a troop, just like the SecDef and Admiral Pilsner ambushed mine. I should be the one thanking you for saving my life.
Whatever you say, brother, let's call it even.
Freddy, you didn't get out just to find me, did you?
Freddy glanced at his friend and then back to the road.
Well, not just to find you. Although that's what sealed the deal on going to the agency and, in all honesty, was a huge part of it. I had to find out why you didn't kill us all that day when you had us in a textbook ambush. I looked at the Claymore setup after we assaulted Ben's cabin, came up empty, and patrolled back to the trailhead. I sent some of the reconnaissance guys out to locate possible hide sites, and sure enough, they found where you had set up. Looks like you had most of the Team 7 armory laid out up there. Laws, an AT-4, an MK-48. It was a good position.
Yeah, well, thanks again. Freddy paused. But like I said, that wasn't the only reason I left.
Really? I thought you loved the teams.
I did. Remember the witch hunts that went down in the wake of the tell-all book on the Big Mish?
Freddy asked, referencing one of the many non-fiction books on the Osama bin Laden mission.
I remember. What a shit show.
The same people that gave the green light to that Hollywood movie starring active duty SEALs and benefited more than a little bit from Bud's tours they gave wealthy donors to the different SEAL foundations suddenly got convenient cases of amnesia. They fried a bunch of guys for off-duty employment, from what I remember.
Yeah, that's about the gist of it. Years before, I had done some teaching at a hunter's marksmanship program in Texas called Bladelands Ranch.
That place is amazing, Rhys said in acknowledgement. I took my snipers out there before our last deployment to Iraq. Beautiful facility in the hill country. Guy that started it made a fortune selling a microbrewery to Coors or Budweiser or something, right?
That's right. Black Buck Brewery. Great stuff.
Anyway, some of us in our off time would go out there on leave to